Our guest today on Meet the Press is Mr. Harold Wilson, the new leader of the British Labour Party, who was elected after the recent death of Hugh Gaitskell. Mr. Wilson has directed his party's economic and financial policies in the House of Commons, and since 1961 has been responsible for leading his party on foreign affairs. If the Labour Party comes into power in Britain in the next election, as many political observers are predicting, Mr. Wilson will be the Prime Minister. And now we're ready for the first question. Lawrence E. Spivak, permanent member of the Meet the Press panel.
Mr. Wilson, you said the other day that your purpose in coming to this country was to listen and to learn. I know you've listened. Have you learned much of significance?
Yes, I've learned an enormous amount. A lot has happened since I was last in the United States, in world affairs, and I've learned more than I could have hoped to expect to
what
learn.
What would you say was the most significant thing you've learned, if you can put your finger on a significant thing?
Well, first, I've learned a good deal of how the government machine works here, which has been very interesting. But I've learned, most of all, the reactions of the administration to the problems of Europe, both in an economic and a defense sense.
One of the reports out of London said that your visit to this country was also to reassure our administration that a change in Britain's government would not harm the West. Do you think you have convinced the leaders you've seen that a change will not harm the West?
That wasn't one of the purposes of coming. I think the administration knew pretty well where the Labour Party stood, where Hugh Gaitskell stood, where I stand on these matters. But I was aware that there are some people in the press, for example, who were a little less than clear about where we stood. I hope I've reassured them.
Well, what do you consider the most important issues confronting the Atlantic alliances today? I think you wanted to find out what we thought they were. What do you think they are?
Yes, first, the question of economic partnership, particularly after the breakdown of the Brussels negotiations. Second, the problem of mobilizing our economic strength so that all of us can continue to expand production year by year and not fall behind our rivals across the Iron Curtain, who are pressing on with their production. Thirdly, to make the Western Alliance, NATO, so far as Europe's concerned, a really effective organization, which at the moment I don't think it fully is.
Mr. Wilson, as you know, there have been many reports about where you stand and what you think and what you do before you came to this country. Now, one of them said that you had a reputation for being anti-American sometimes and often pro-Soviet. Would you like to take this opportunity to make clearer your attitude on the Soviet
Union?
Yes,
absolutely.
And on the United States?
Yes, certainly. I'm not aware of any evidence to support these views. I've always taken the view that Britain and the United States, as partners, should be free to speak very frankly to one another, that Britain needs the United States needs Britain. But so far as our foreign and defense policy are concerned, as I've said, the Western Alliance is the center of our policy. Of course we want to have dialogues with the Soviet Union. Of course we want, from a position of strength, to be able to negotiate settlements of big outstanding problems like disarmament and Berlin, but within the context of the Western Alliance.
Well, can you tell us how serious you think the Soviet threat is to the security of the West?
How serious the threat is? I think it is a threat that might become serious if we once allow ourselves to drop our guard, whether in a military or in any other context. But I've always felt that their economic threat was perhaps more serious in immediate terms. I was one of the first to say that they were going to become a big industrial power when people still thought of them as a crowd of peasants, and when people still thought that it was purely the military problem we had to face. And I think that their technological activities, their science, above all, their ability to link their scientific research to their production problems has put them in a fairly strong position, particularly for converting, or some might say subverting, the minds of men in undercommitted areas. That's why we cannot afford to waste our strength in the luxury of unemployment.
And one more report that has given the American people an impression about you. The New York Herald Tribune, for example, today said that you praise Soviet Premier Khrushchev equally with President Kennedy for statesmanship, and I quote, statesmanship, in last October's Cuban crisis. If you were correctly quoted, you tell us what was statesmanlike about Mr. Khrushchev's withdrawal from Cuba?
I remember the quotation perfectly well. I was referring there, after discussing the whole beginning of the Cuban problem and the way in which it came about, I was then talking in the context of the final weekend before the crisis ended. When, as I said, as the British Prime Minister said, and I don't think he's ever been accused of excessive Soviet leanings, that we felt the world owed a debt to both of them for their statesmanship in those critical few hours when the world did appear to be on the brink of war.
We'll be back with Meet the Press and more questions for our guest, Mr. Harold Wilson, the leader of the British Labour Party. And now resuming our interview, our guest today is Mr. Harold Wilson, the leader of the British Labour Party. You've just met Lawrence E. Spivak, permanent member of the panel. Our other reporters today are Philip Jalin of the Wall Street Journal, Henry Brandon of the London Sunday Times, and Robert McNeil of NBC News. We'll continue the questions now with Mr. Jalin.
Mr. Wilson, in this country, the Labour Party is very often associated with socialism, which is considered to be very far to the left. Could you, for the benefit of American political students, identify yourself in the American political spectrum? Where would you fit as between Senator Goldwater and Norman Thomas?
I don't know enough about the American political spectrum, and it's dangerous to draw parallels, but I would think that the Labour Party and I myself are on foreign and domestic and on foreign affairs, defence, pretty close, I think, to the Democratic administration. There are certain differences, as you know, on world affairs, but in the main we'd be identified there. I don't know enough about the views of particular groups in the United States about socialization and so on, but our position is, of course, that we are socialists, all of us. Hugh Gates calls a socialist, I'm a socialist. We intend to renationalize the steel industry, which we consider to be essential, but for the rest, our plan is mainly a social security plan. We have last week announced our new proposals there, and also to mobilize new industries, both privately and publicly owned, so that we can make a bigger contribution in the world.
Well, now, where would this mobilization end? You mentioned the other day in your speech at the press club that you were not satisfied or displeased with the profits of pharmaceutical firms in Great Britain, and you thought that the government should do something about it. And one of the proposals I think you made was that the government should build competing firms or buy into the existing ones. Is this not extending nationalization in disguise beyond the steel industry?
Well, by nationalization, we mean in the classical way, taking over the assets of privately owned firms and turning them into publicly owned firms. So far as pharmaceuticals are concerned, when you have pharmaceutical companies, some of them of American origin, earning 70% on capital in a single year out of the British taxpayer through selling their drugs to the National Health Service, something has got to be done. If it can't be done by price control, by bringing the prices paid down, as I hope it could, we might have on certain standard preparations, which account for a high proportion of the sales, produce some of these drugs in state-owned laboratories or in private-owned laboratories that will work to more reasonable prices. In other cases, we might have to have some selling company in which some of the shares are held by the government so that if undue profits are made, they are shared back again with the taxpayer who created them.
Mr. Brandon.
Mr. Wilson, you've now seen most of the key policymakers in the Kennedy administration. Do you feel that you see more or less eye to eye with them, if you could tell us, do you see some serious difficulties ahead for the future?
On the questions that I discussed this past week with the leaders of the administration, we see eye to eye on a great number of issues, particularly on developing the Atlantic Partnership, and I think also on the whole question of developing the underdeveloped areas of the world. Of course, there are some basic differences on certain items. British government many years ago recognized communist China. The American government does not. We support entry of Red China into the UN, partly as a means of bringing, to some extent, within the control of civilization, if that's possible. There are differences here, and we have still to examine, when the details are clearer, the proposals for a multilateral force in NATO. On the whole, we want to transfer the deterrent that Britain has, or pretended deterrent that Britain has, of course, into a NATO context, but we are not sure enough yet of the details or the case for a multilateral force, and we might have reservations about that.
Now, how about the role that Germany should play in NATO? I think there seems to be a difference between your point of view and that of the administration.
Well, we have said very plainly that we are against, for example, a European deterrent, that is, a European deterrent without America, in which West European countries would become a nuclear power. We're very much against that because we think it would weaken NATO. It would distract their attention from the work of NATO. It will be an alliance within an alliance, which is weakening. And also, of course, it will be highly provocative to the Soviet Union and make it harder to get reasonable agreements, defensible agreements, with the Soviet Union. And we are also opposed to, not only to Germany, but to any other country having a finger on the button. We think the logic of the defense situation is that the United States is the custodian on behalf of the West of the strategic deterrent, and we would be very much opposed to Germany or to other European countries having the right to initiate nuclear action against the wishes of the United States, if anybody really contemplates that.
Mr. McNeil.
Mr. Wilson, you say you don't want a finger on the button, but you seem to imply, and you have said that you want greater consultation between the Western allies. Does this mean that you want more say in when the button is pushed? And is this realistic?
When there is time, and there might not always be time, one can imagine circumstances where there are only a few minutes in which a decision has to be taken. Yes, we would like to see consultation as to whether the circumstances are such as to justify a decision of this kind. That, in a sense, is giving the other NATO allies, including Britain, if not a finger on the safety catch, or at any rate the right to be consulted and their views to be collected before the ultimate decision is taken by the President. But that's a very different thing from saying that any of them can initiate action or take action against the wishes of the United States.
In giving up your nuclear weapons, you've called it Britain's nuclear posturing. Would you be prepared to use your stockpile and your considerable sophisticated know-how to bargain with, for instance, to bargain your way into Europe, or would you simply dump the warheads into the sea?
Well, we certainly wouldn't dump the warheads into the sea, or the V-bombers, or anything of that kind. Remember, we can't take a decision until we are the government. If we become the government, we have to see much more about the defense situation than Parliament has so far been told. But our present thinking is that we would do nothing to maintain, by new action, new orders, new weapons, the British deterrent. And as soon as maybe, I think we should want to transfer our nuclear force into NATO, in return perhaps for a greater say in NATO's targeting work and other important work of NATO. And I think that that is what we should be doing quite early on. And we would transfer them on the basis that they were then at the disposal of NATO to be collectively controlled by NATO, not on Mr. Macmillan's basis after Nassau, of putting them in and getting a kind of cloakroom ticket under which he could withdraw them whenever he thought that was right for some national war in which we might be engaged. I can't myself foresee the kind of war that in which he might want to use nuclear power independently of the alliance.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Wilson, I am to understand that it is a fixed policy of the Labour Party to abandon your nuclear deterrent, in time, certainly.
To abandon our so-called independent, so-called British, which it isn't, and so-called deterrent, which it's very doubtful. Our view is that it adds nothing to Western strength. What it does do is to use up so many of our resources in real terms and financial terms that we are unable to make an adequate contribution to NATO ground forces in conventional terms. If we were to drop this pretense, and it is a pretense of being an independent nuclear power, we would have more resources in order to strengthen British forces in Germany, to see that they were properly equipped, to see that they were properly mobile and could play a full role in NATO. Otherwise, we think the situation in Europe is very, very dangerous if our conventional forces are not adequate to resist, shall we say, a Soviet push.
Mr. Wilson, do you think the British people are behind you in this? Do you think that they are prepared to accept the status of a second-rate military power, which is what you're proposing?
We're not proposing that we accept the status of a second-rate military power. We're proposing that we come to terms with the facts of the world. We tried to be an independent nuclear power when we set out on our one big missile program, Blue Streak. Well, that came to nothing. From that moment forward, if we were to have any nuclear weapons at all, it must be those that we could get from the Americans. Skybolt was one, that fell to the ground. Then now there's talk about Polaris. As to the British people, well, this has been an issue in recent by-elections where the results have been absolutely catastrophic For Mr. Macmillan's government. Everybody knows where we stand on this policy, and they've voted for the Labour Party.
But, Mr. Wilson, aren't you really accepting a position of a second-rate military power? You're not even going to try to become a first-rate military power if you give up the whole question of a nuclear deterrent.
If being a first-rate military power means being a nuclear power, that is right. What you have said is quite right. We accept and believe this is right, that there only are and should be only two nuclear powers in the world today, the Soviet Union and the United States. Unless and until we reach the happy situation where we get a world disarmament agreement outlawing nuclear weapons altogether.
But it's quite unrealistic
to pretend that we could become an independent nuclear power. Our resources don't run to it. But I believe we can be a very important military power if we concentrate our resources on conventional weapons.
But you're not able to control the question of other countries having a nuclear deterrent. France is going to have it. Some other countries may have it if there is no agreement between the nations. So that you really are saying that from now on and for all time, England is going to accept the status of being a second-rate military power and isn't even going to try to be a first-rate power.
I think this has been our position, as I say, ever since Blue Streak collapsed. And it is a mockery, I think, to be going, shall we say, cap in hand to another country, however friendly, to the United States, for weapons, and then calling ourselves a first-rate military power. You're not a military power if you're dependent on somebody else for your weapons. As for France, yes, we're very much against the French deterrent, and we very much regret that they were encouraged in the pursuit of that deterrent by Mr. Macmillan as in his attempt to get French goodwill to Britain's entry into the common market last year. We warned Mr. Macmillan against that. But how effective the French deterrent's going to be, I'm very doubtful. We think that in about 6 or 7 years, if they're not given special help by Britain or America, their deterrent will be about as effective as Britain's deterrent is today. And ours is already becoming obsolete.
Mr. Shalom.
Mr. Wilson, it's been commonly attributed to President Nasser, without drawing the parallel too fine, that he said in justifying his mission that there was a role wandering around in search of a hero. I'm wondering if at this rather crossroads situation for Britain, with the common market doors closed and the Commonwealth somewhat bruised by the negotiations and the Skybolt affair, whether you think there is a role for Britain wandering around for Harold Wilson, and if so, what is it?
Well, I'm not sure who's wandering around or what the problems are, but I think it's quite clear that Britain has an important role to play in the world. Certainly we want to play a role in Europe, but we were not going to go into Europe, for instance, in the common market, if that meant cutting off all our trading ties with the Commonwealth and indeed with the United States, as would have been the position under the common market's agricultural program with their high penal import levies and the rest of it. We have a role to play in Europe. It's very obscure at the moment to say what it is because one doesn't know what President de Gaulle will veto next. We have a bigger role to play in the Atlantic Partnership. There may be changes in Europe. We may find the Germans, for example, if their government changes, as it may, working very closely with us for a more integrated Atlantic Partnership. They may be a very, very different country in a few months' time. But we believe we have perhaps a bigger role still through the Commonwealth in the United Nations. Even the biggest countries in the world, even America, even in the Soviet Union, can't go on regardless of the feelings of world opinion, and world opinion, for good or ill, is now mobilized very considerably through the United Nations, where a lot of the voting power and speaking power particularly comes from new countries from Africa and Asia. Because of our membership of the Commonwealth, which is the greatest multiracial association in the world, we believe we have a great power to influence world opinion, a power going quite beyond any measurement of our present military power.
You mentioned West Germany and a close association with West Germany, which, as you say, may be a very different country.
Yeah.
Will it be a different enough country to go along with your Berlin proposals and perhaps also with your proposals about European nuclear force, which I understand the West Germans are...
Well, certainly the... SPD, the German Socialist Party, are, I think, fully in line with what I've been saying about Germany and Berlin. When I did a Meet the Press program, if I may say that, with the West German television 2 or 3 weeks ago, I immediately had telegrams of warm approval and support from Willy Brandt of Berlin, from Fritz Ehrler and others. I think we can get along together if they're the government, yes.
Mr. Brandon.
Rightly or wrongly, Mr. Wilson, you've always been sort of associated with the left wing of the Labour Party, which has a certain anti-American bias. And I was wondering, if you pursue a policy in broad agreement with the United States, whether you think you might have some difficulties within the party.
I don't think so. You know, these phrases left and right are becoming much more meaningless than they were. I have, on occasions, I've always followed not individuals or been a satellite of any man, but I've tried to judge each issue on its merits. And sometimes I was, yes, in alliance with an Aaron Bevan or whatever it might be, whoever it might be, on questions like German rearmament and other things on which we took a strong line. But I don't think anyone's ever permanently identified me with the left. On the present position, in the debates on the Nassau Agreement and defense earlier this year, the speeches I made, which were the toughest pro-NATO speeches, the toughest anti-neutralist speeches we've ever had from our side of the House of Commons, these speeches were greatly cheered by the left and reprinted in our paper Tribune, which is regarded as a very left-wing paper.
Since you mentioned Nye Bevan,
yes.
I think in 51, when you resigned with him in sympathy, he said that he did not like Britain to be tied too closely to the wheel of American diplomacy. I was wondering whether this is now such past history or whether this still lingers on.
Well, it is a long time ago, but when he made a very long speech giving his reasons for resignation, I disagreed with some of it, and I made another speech the next day giving my reasons for resignation, and they were quite simply that we were being asked by the government, of which we were members, to embark on a rearmament program that was beyond our physical capacity. It was a purely factual, pragmatic question. Within about 6 or 8 months, we had a new government under Winston Churchill. He cut the arms program by half, and I think he proved that we'd been right.
We have about 2 minutes, Mr. McNeil.
Mr. Wilson, you've mentioned the West German Social Democrats. Do you think the fact that your party and Willy Brandt appear in some ways to be poised for victory indicates a new swing to the left in Europe? And if so, do you think the Kennedy administration is sympathetic to this swing?
I think it certainly indicates a swing to the left in the two countries concerned, and we may find it in other countries. It's hard to measure. So far as the Kennedy administration is concerned, I'm sure they will work with any government that they find confronting them. But since both my own party and Willy Brandt's party are so much orientated towards the Atlantic Alliance and the Atlantic Partnership, I think it will make it possible to work very closely with the administration in Washington.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Wilson, if you came to power, you'd make a completely socialist state of Great Britain, I believe. What place is there for a constitutional monarch under your system of socialism?
We have our own definition of socialism, and we say it will be a mixed economy in which the government will control the commanding heights of the economy so that we can get full employment and full production. There is exactly the same position for a constitutional monarch in Britain under a Labour government as under any other government. We are completely identified with the present constitution of Britain. We just want to make other parts of the constitution, such as Parliament, and the mobilization of industry a little more efficient and purposeful than it is today.
Mr. Wilson, you said the other day that you had doubts that the U.S. administration was enthusiastic about the Nassau Agreement. Just what gave you those doubts?
I meant whether they were enthusiastic about giving Polaris submarines to Britain on the basis that Britain could use them on a national and not an alliance basis. I had doubts about that because every statement or speech we've ever heard from the United States administration, I think particularly of Secretary McNamara's speech at Ann Arbor, shows they were against the proliferation of nuclear weapons and wanted to have everything on an alliance basis. And everything I've ever heard since, I think, confirms the view that they do not want separate, independent national deterrence.
Well, do you think they would like to renegotiate or denegotiate that agreement, or have you repudiated?
I couldn't, as an opposition leader, negotiate with the present government. I think if we were the government, we would have little difficulty in renegotiating that aspect of the agreement.
Gentlemen, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I see that our time is up. Thank you very much, Mr. Wilson, for being with us. Next week on Meet the Press, our guest will be the chief of the Foreign Aid Program, Mr. David Bell, administrator of the Agency for International Development. Now, this is Ned Brooks saying goodbye for Mr. Harold Wilson, and Meet the Press.